Okay. See. Okay. So, the three main subject of our review through these slides, which I essentially see for the first time with you, are the confined space, Lotto, lockout tagout, and ODH. Okay, so confined space. This is the definition for confined space. Clearly, there is a permit required to be able to work in confined space. And essentially, it's a space that doesn't allow you to move freely, to escape freely, and where there is the possibility of the presence of something that is dangerous or hazardous, like gas or electrical equipment, other things that makes the situation even more dangerous from that point of view. These are examples of what are considered to be confined space. Typically, vessels that you need to go in to clean or to repair, pump enclosure, like sump pump. That our presence a little bit everywhere. Cryostats and things of that nature. So there is a definition, there is a list of confined space at Fermilab. If you click this link, you go through a very, very long list of hundreds and hundreds of confined space. For what concern SIDECT, most of these confined space are pits where there is a sump pump, and they're usually well marked, and nobody should get into that space unless they have a permit to do so. Normally, there are cases where you might not need a permit, but that is only if all possible dangers have been removed. We'll see in the later slide what I mean by that. The entry procedure is defined by this fashion 4230.03. And often, let's say, in a normal situation, there are rules that applies unless all physical hazards have been completely removed from the place. The other thing is that when accessing confined space, there should be always a set of equipment available in case of an accident in order to be able to extract the person from the confined space. This could be this tripod or a winch to winch the person out, or some sort of a hook to grab the person and take it out. And people should also have a fall protection harness, which also allows for extracting the person from the place in case of need. And obviously, this is all highly hazardous work and needs training, needs a proper HA and everything else before work can begin. Please interrupt me if you have any questions. So, another thing that maybe not everybody might be aware of is that in large vessels, there is always the possibility that that gases will stratify, and depending on the relative weight with respect to air, they will rise or sink or more or less stay in the middle. So usually, before any work can begin in such circumstances, there is a measurement that is done vertically every 4 feet to recognize the type of residual gas which is present inside the vessel. So whenever such work needs to be done, the first thing is that we should ask ourselves is if a permit is required, and identify all the present or potential hazards. In the list that lists all the confined space places around the lab, there is also a column that explicitly says whether or not a permit is required in order to access that place or not. So that is already your first hint that you're getting the permit. But in any case, even if this no permit is required, you still need to go through the assessment of the situation to make sure that no other hazards are present before work can begin. And if indeed there are no hazards present and the space is classified as no permit required, the space can be temporarily reclassified, and then work can start in that manner, which will simplify the work. In other words, if at all it is possible to preemptively remove any hazard from the confined space and consequently then reclassify the space as no permit required, that is better than leave the hazard present and then go through the whole procedure, because clearly one of the most effective way of reducing any risk is to remove the risk altogether to begin with, rather than trying to mitigate the presence of the risk. Okay, now there are three examples of accidents that occurred. The first one was a work done on a sump pump controller, where a person reached into an energized controller with unguarded parts to test the pump operation. The second was a LINAC crowbar assembly issue in the LINAC assembly crowbar, where the person contacted the energized part inside an enclosure by removing a mounting bolt. And the third happened in January 2025 in IB1. That had to do with the pump coupling, motor and pump, the couple between the motor and pump, where They were attempting to reverse rotate the pump in order to test it. And there was a mechanical accident where the coupling was shattered, which we will go into more details later. So why this happened? In all these three cases, workers were troubleshooting equipment that was not working correctly. And in each case, the troubleshooting process pointed to a further test or component replacement that was not identified in the original planned scope. And no work pause was taken in order first to determine whether the new step that they were supposed to take was potentially hazardous and how to mitigate. Scope creep can find new hazards, and scope creep is particularly common during troubleshooting. And this is, I think, is an experience that we all of us have, because obviously troubleshooting is something that we often do, and at the very beginning of our work, we not necessarily know exactly where that troubleshooting will lead us. And we might not be prepared. We might not have the proper equipment. We might not have the proper tools. But we feel compelled to keep going because we want to have a result at the end of our work. And often that is not the safest way to proceed. So here there are some action items. Is troubleshooting part of the work done by your group? If so, what kinds of equipment does your group troubleshoot? Is the scope of work clearly defined before work starts? Does work get paused when conditions suggest additional non-scoped tasks or steps? And are there equipment or systems that you work on or with that expose workers to electrical, mechanical, pressure, falling, or ergonomic hazards? And could changes or improvements be made to prevent or minimize those exposures? So I want to pause here for a second and see if anybody has anything they want to share or their questions, because I think this is quite common in the work that we do. So if anybody wants to add anything now, please.
I have a question.
Yes, right. Yeah.
So
If you speak louder.
I know that on the accelerator case, when people go to do some work in the tunnel, they feel forms and
Yes.
somebody keeps track of what is happening, somebody checks if they have all the right gear. When we do work, let's say at Sidon, do we have an equivalent system of people do, I mean, reporting that they are troubleshooting or what exactly they're doing so that somebody, a supervisor, can keep an eye on what they're doing?
Okay, let me try to answer. So there are two type of works here at SciLab, right? One is just the regular work that we do in the clean room where scientists mostly are working on detector parts, testing modules or power supply and so on and so forth. Definitely their troubleshooting is part of the daily experience. Generally speaking, there is a understanding of the parts that you are troubleshooting, that you're working on. For example, it's a module that doesn't work very well, you start connecting, disconnecting. But this is all within, you know, low voltage, low current regulations. So there is no need for extra precautions, except for having everybody clearly understanding the general situation in which they're working. And then there are other works that are done. For example, contractors working on HVAC system, or contractor working on other equipment that we have around the lab. And usually those are fall under the ISD supervision. We have a contact person normally here beside that. Often is Jamie, or could be somebody else. So the scope of the work is clearly defined. There is an HA, because that type of work is clearly much, you know, higher level of risk than troubleshooting a known working module.
Okay.
So,
yes.
So there's one thing that you got to be careful of, though. If you're troubleshooting a piece of electronics or something, most of the stuff in there could be low voltage and harmless, but there could be AC power going into that thing, and that the screws or the bolt or the bus that's in there, you could accidentally short it out, touch it or drop a tool in there and start a fire or shock yourself. And, you know, that's something that we shouldn't be doing. So there's AC power in a chassis that you're troubleshooting, and you need to go through the hazard analysis process and make sure that we're not doing anything wrong.
Okay, Rick.
Yeah, thanks, Nicola. I wanted to ask a question about the previous section on confined spaces. Now, I remember from long ago, we used to have specialty training for confined spaces. And to my knowledge, all confined spaces, one, require a permit, and two, the confined space is physically locked with only specific individuals who have keys so that you can open that confined space. Has that changed recently? Do you know?
I don't believe all confined spaces are locked.
No,
I think it's very easy to get yourself into trouble with that.
Okay, certainly all of the confined spaces that I'm aware of all have locks on them.
If we know about them, that's true. We
yeah.
generally do that, but there's confined spaces we don't always predict or know about, and that's why you have to be careful.
Understood, but what I also remember is just to access a confined space required specialty training. And
yes.
Is that no longer the case?
Yes, but there are special cases where
no, I think there's a difference, but you're conflating permit required versus training required. You need a training.
No, actually, I'm not conflating those two. Those two are different. I'm certainly
okay.
aware of that. What I'm saying is that just to access a confined space required specialty training.
I believe so, yeah.
A permit was required or not.
Correct.
I think you're correct. So the all the confined spaces that you can find, for example, in that list, those are identified. And in order to access them, you need to have training. That's right. But there might be situations where you find yourself in a confined space that has not been necessarily identified. I don't know, some equipment that you need to crawl in order to remove something from it, or God knows what, right? It's not, that was not necessarily in the list.
So this is, in principle, what you've identified is something that hasn't been initially identified as a confined space.
Yes.
Or hasn't
yes.
been at least labeled as such. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's times when we inadvertently create confined spaces and we don't realize it, or they haven't been identified yet. And so that's
okay.
why it's, you know, limited access, cramp situations, all of those things, That's why they define it in fashion that way, not just whether somebody's previously identified it or not. Okay. So you can always ask your safety people, hey, I'd like to go work in here. Stop. Don't do what you're suspicious of. Go ask your safety people, is this a confined space? Do I need a permit? And if so, then you have to identify it as that, or you have to work with it in that way.
Right. But
Most
to
of
your
the people in
knowledge,
this, most of the people in this session here aren't going to deal with confined spaces, but a few, and that's why we're, just want to make sure you know how to identify one.
okay.
Back off and get help from safety.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. And then in the third case of the three that I mentioned earlier, the new hazard was mechanical, not electrical. So when the motor was started, the coupling between the motor and the pump cracked in two pieces, landed about 10 feet away. And 1 mitigating action that was not applied was the coupling guards. Even though the coupling guards were primarily intended to prevent contact between people and their clothing with rotating equipment, those guards would have likely contained the parts if they had been put back in place before starting the motor. So that was an action that could have been taken and wasn't. Okay, then there is this accident in Los Alamos on January 9, 2025. A subcontractor employee fractured their right middle finger and severed the tips of their right middle and ring fingers while performing preventive maintenance on computer room air handlers. C1 and two other subcontractor technicians C2 and C3 electrically locked and tagged out involved the air handler motor by locally disconnecting the switch and verifying the zero energy power was supplied to the equipment. But the fan was assembled, sorry, the fan assembly continued to free spin at a rapid rate due to the operation of adjacent air handlers, which were sharing a common plenum. And the worker, C1, entered the air handler plenum, attempting to slow down a free-spinning fan belt with the palms of their hands. And then the belt caught their glove and pulled their hand into the fan belt pulley. And then C1 notifies C2, C2 notifies C3, C3 transported C1 to the occupational medicine for evaluation. Clearly, that was not a good thing to do. And the procedure was not properly done in the sense that they did lock out, tug out the fan that they were supposed to work on, but they failed to recognize that due to the presence of other fans, the were creating air pressure, and that even if not energized directly, this fan will just keep spinning. And trying to stop the belt with your hand for prevent the fan to spin is not a good idea. And no work pause was taken to figure out how to stop the rotation without having a worker getting into the line of fire.
Nicole, can I make a comment?
Yes,
So
please.
I said this in our group meeting when this came up. It's easy enough to look at something like that and say, well, obviously you shouldn't stick your hand into a moving fan belt, but somebody did, somebody who was smart enough to get hired by Los Alamos Laboratory. And I think a lot of the time the question you have to ask is, why is somebody so eager to get their work done that they're sticking their hand into the machinery? And often the answer is there's pressure coming from somewhere else, from above or from whoever's supervising the work to just get it done. And sometimes people will react to those incentives by doing something that in a vacuum looks very foolish and is. But I think people don't show up to work in the morning with the intention of losing their fingers, but sometimes it happens. And you should take seriously that you need to make sure that people feel like they have time to do their work safely and that they understand that nothing is so important that it can't be done.
I completely agree.
Yeah, very good talent.
Okay, action items. What tasks or activities expose you to hazards other than electricity? Even though primarily this job was an electrical one, at the end of the day, there was a mechanical issue that caused the injuries. And so you need often to have a broader approach to the work that you have to perform, and not just concentrate on the obvious, because there are things that clearly, if they break, may put you in danger. Are there more effective ways to protect workers from these hazards that are currently used? What could be done to implement them? So these are questions that we should ask ourselves before organizing the work or before doing any work. In the first two instances, workers reached into an enclosure with exposed conductors to do a task, manually operate the pump or remove a mounting bolt that should not have required exposure to hazardous energy. So obviously the equipment should have been switched off and tagged out. Personnel designing and selecting equipment should also try to incorporate features that minimize the exposure of workers to hazards, as outlined in the NIOSH hierarchy of controls. As you can see from the triangle on the right-hand side, if I can completely eliminate the hazard, that is preferable. If I can replace the hazard with something else, is the second in the list of preferable things to do. I can do engineering controls, which is isolate people from the hazard. There could be administrative controls, which change in procedures. And the last one that helps you is the personal protective equipment. So if I need to do a work that is dangerous, the personal protective equipment is the last resort. If I could do that work eliminating completely the hazard, that would be a much better solution. So, for example, if I need to intervene in anything which is electrical, taking away the energy from that piece of equipment is clearly the most relevant safety action I can take, rather than having gloves or rubber shoes or whatever. So that has to be taken into account. Okay, are you working on design or installation that might expose worker to hazard? Have you identified the energy isolating devices that workers will need to use to apply lockout tagout? Will they accept padlocks without using adapters? That is also something that's often occurred, which is that you want to switch off the equipment you need to work on, but the switch doesn't have an obvious way to place a padlock. So you need an adapter. So these are all things that you have to consider before you start your work, and not bypass any of these safety features. Because then anybody that opens a cabinet that sees a switch being off, you'll have the tendency to say, why is it off? I will just switch it on again. And if you don't have locked it, nobody knows why that switch is off. Okay. Troubleshooting is a risky activity. Broken equipment may present hazards that are not found when the equipment is in a normal condition. It is difficult and labor-intensive to develop a thorough troubleshooting work plan that will identify most failures. And obviously, without a thorough work plan, the troubleshooter essentially develops the work plan on the fly, as each troubleshooting step is identified and then performed step by step. And sometimes, as you go step by step, you go so far away from the original intention that is almost a completely different work than you are performing. And safe troubleshooting demands the work pause to identify hazards and develop mitigations at each step in the process. And time pressure, as Ben was commenting earlier, often compounds the high mental demands of troubleshooting with pressure to work hastily. If your group does troubleshooting, identify equipment that can present unexpected hazards when it is broken. How can those potential hazards be safely approached? Do you work or equipment or systems that are so critical, expensive, or hazardous that developing a thorough troubleshooting work plan is a worthwhile investment? These are all questions that you should ask yourself before making an action and going through the process of troubleshooting. Do you implement work pauses for planning at each step when you are troubleshooting without the previously developed thorough work plan? Are you and your line management committed to defending the need to troubleshoot carefully and deliberately, even when others desire quick results? Okay, so this is the end of the second section. And now we go to the third section, which is oxygen deficiency hazard. And then, as I said, Dell will go through the specific of the cyanide circuit in the plant and work at Black Sea. Okay, so the ODH in general is regulated by Fashion 4240 that contains basic information on ODH classifications, specific areas within groups, departments, and their requirements for different classifications, procedures and control measures, alarm response, personal O2 monitors and fixed in place oxygen monitors. Recent incidents, IB1 alarm response, and release of N2 gas due to proper portable blower usage, and then recommendations. Okay, our normal breathing atmosphere consists of mainly three gases, nitrogen at the level of 78%. Oxygen at the level of 21%, then argon and other gases at the level of 1% of this. An oxygen deficient atmosphere is defined as any type of oxygen concentration below 19.5%. 19.5% corresponds to climbing up to 14,000 feet or over 4,000 meters. So it's pretty low concentration of oxygen. This oxygen level is defined by OSHA and defines the alarm set point for fixed in place as well as personal oxygen monitors used at Fermilab.
By the way, that's wrong.
Yeah.
The third largest gas in the atmosphere is water.
Right. I saw argon here, and I mean many. Yeah, there are list of long list of gases that get the 1%. Okay, so what are the effects of low oxygen? Okay, I don't want to go through, but essentially you get dizziness at the level of 17, 18%. You can't really reason anymore. And at the level of 6%, death may occur in 5 to 8 minutes. Okay, then these are the link to the fashion. This is also a link to a video that is actually quite nice and goes through an example of what happened in a refinery somewhere in the United States, and goes through essentially the incident and just to show how silly in a certain sense the situation was and how quickly that led to the loss of two workers that were performing some work in a confined space. I think I will skip it, but you can look at it. By the way, I don't know if everybody should have the slides, right? I think if you don't have the slides, maybe I can create a.
Yeah. I don't
I
think
can
it really
create an
makes sense to
Indigo.
everyone. Yeah. It depends
No.
on the division that
Right.
you're
So maybe
partnering
I
with.
upload them on. I'll send around an Indigo link with these slides, so that people can look at the slides by themselves.
What's the issue?
No, I was just maybe I don't go through the video here, but if people wants to look at the video and look at the slides even later, I will
Yeah.
upload them on Indigo. Okay, so all the age classifications, there are three. There is an ODH0, which is actually divided in two. One is a true ODH0, which I think everything is true ODH0 everywhere. And then there is an engineered ODH0, which means that there is a potential hazard. But through engineering control, then the let's say the hazard is again zero. But this is because, for example, ventilation is switched on, or there is an automatic switch off of the hazardous gas and things of that nature. Then there is ODH1 and ODH2, which is the most hazardous. Here, we don't have any ODH1 or ODH2, but we do have often an ODH class 0, an engineered ODH class 0. Again, for example, Lab C is classified like that because of the presence of the CO2 cooling plant. But also several labs at IERC, for example. I have an engineer that ODH0 classification.
It's also true for site for everywhere where we have nitrogen distributed, we put in controls in place so that there isn't an uncontrolled release from the
Yes.
nitrogen door that supplies the nitrogen for purge gas or whatever that we use it for.
Okay, so I skip these unless somebody wants to say something about because as I said, Dell will go through the UPSI specific. I'll skip that. Okay, so all personnel entering on the ODH posted area must be aware of the hazards, know how to recognize ODH alarm. siren or strobe, and how to recognize cryo or the EDH hazards, how to safely exit the area, and how to call 3131. All personnel entering ODH1 and ODH2, but as I said, we don't have any of those, must be additionally medically qualified, trained, and supplied with ODH equipment, personal monitors or escape packs, if required per ODH assessment. And all personnel must be aware that rescue must be conducted by emergency personnel. So this last bullet means that as you would have seen in the video, for example, of that accident with the refinery, that if there is an accident due to oxygen deficiency, despite of the fact that your first instinct would be to try to rescue the person, there is a high potential hazard in doing that because you might essentially fall in the same trap, and very quickly, not having oxygen to breathe, you will be a second victim instead of helping the person that was unconscious. And this is why here is written that only the fire department personnel would rescue a person in that situation. On the other hand, I think to some extent, if you know, your judgment is important. So there might be situations where a prompt intervention might actually be better than waiting 5 minutes for the fire brigade to show up. This has to be, depends a lot on the situation. Clearly, in a confined space where somebody is unconscious, I would not recommend to go in there and try to rescue that person. But there might be a situation where you can easily open the doors and easily try to have a much better quick ventilation of the place. And in that case, you can go in. But always try to alert everybody else around you so that more and more people are aware of the situation and can help you. And in any case, you have to call 3131 as soon as possible. Okay, so I skipped the ODH1. Be aware that access to engineered ODH0 areas is allowed for non-qualified and non-trained personnel. These areas still contain cryogenic and pressurized gas sources that can displace oxygen. So the only thing that you need really to know is that you're entering such an area because it has to be marked. You need to be aware of what that means, and you need to be able to respond to an alarm. But usually, if you have an alarm that sounds, you go out, you just evacuate. And obviously, you need to know how to evacuate, evacuation routes. This is the chart for the fixed in place O2 monitors. This is a picture of the personal oxygen monitors. So if you are in a place where you are aware of the fact that there is a leak or other things, be sure that you now consider that place with a higher level of risk. Because of the leak or other normal situation in place. So call 3131 if you are not sure of what's going on. It might be a leak of compressed air, but you don't know. So in case of you don't know what's going on, please call out and call 3131. Okay, this is the incident on ID1.
So, Nicola, just a real quick question. On the previous slide, you had a bullet item, or it says in here to notify operations. Does everybody know what that means?
Okay, the way I interpret these is that I want to notify the people responsible for that lab, for example. If I am in a place where I see that there is some leak or pressure release or anything like that, I will try to call somebody that that is supposed to, to know more than I do, or a person responsible for the lab, or the technician responsible for the lab, and go from there. Operations, yes, I don't know.
This is probably an artifact of when they
This is
made this. It
probably
had to do with the Tevatron
cut and paste from CDF or something.
or some experiment that's got cryo going on.
Cryo technician in the control room, yes.
But in part, the reason that I'm asking this question is in many cases we have signage up, particularly for the ODH0 locations. And there's no phone number other than 3131 to call, or no responsible individual often. So that's the reason I was asking, is this going to be the ops center and in the basement of Wilson Hall? Is it the main control room? Is it an individual that has their name posted? That would be worthwhile for folks to clarify.
Yeah,
I
I mean,
think there is
operations has a small O there, so I think it.
I think there is something in our procedures for Lab C that that deal with this point.
At G minus two, they still wanted us to call the main control room, but that was written into the specific operations procedures for what to do when there's an ODH alarm. So it may not be the same for something someplace out at sidewalk.
I'm going to put a note because I'm taking notes for feedback, that what you said in here should be clarified.
Wouldn't it be a good idea, as a practical sense, when you say wheel in a 160-liter door into Lab B there for some reason, that somebody who's responsible for that door has his name on that door, whether it be just a hanging tag or whatever, and that way when somebody walks through there and they see the vent valve just blowing off like all get out, hey, who do I call? Well, nobody else in the area knows except for the guy that brought the 160-liter door in there for the first place. So he should be the one that you would call and say, you know, your door's kind of messed up.
I think even more so, before you even bring that doer in, you should be notifying the facility manager.
Or the facility manager's name on it,
Yes,
phone
whoever's
number.
in charge of the building, yeah.
That way
Just
there'd
because
be.
you don't know whether that hundred, you're not even sure. Well, maybe you are, but
You
maybe
are.
you're not sure whether that 160-liter door would violate an ODH.
Right. But he's still the person that's walking through there doesn't know that number or name necessarily.
Yeah, I think that's a good
That's a good
suggestion.
point.
Yeah.
Yes.
I know, example, even the outside doors. Now, granted, they don't have close a explicit ODH hazard, but when they start venting off ridiculously, somebody who's walking by might say, gee, who should I call? There is no name on the door that says you should call Dell and have him come look at it to fix that problem.
Right.
And it's not an ODH scare, it's not a hazard to anybody except for Spog. But it does need to be looked at.
Well, Jerry, is there a policy or rule that you have to have names on these doors? No. Okay.
No, I mean,
Okay.
it could be that you're just replacing a door that's empty, right? And so, when you're running one of these things, it should have an operational readiness clearance. The facility manager should be aware of what's going on. And if you see one of those things emitting cryogens or whatever, cloud, a gas cloud, then first thing you should do is leave and then call the person responsible for that area. And on the
Yes.
ORCs, the name of the person should be on there. So, but it's a good point. You need to know who to call. But.
The practice that I've started with at least the ODH analyses that I've done for this building and IERC is we have a little summary sheet that says the name of the installation and the people who are responsible for it, and a list of here's everything you're approved for, and that's posted somewhere in the room. It's not necessarily going to be on the actual door, but it'll be on the wall somewhere.
Yeah, but if you know if something starts happening, don't wait around to go look for a call-in list. Get out, and then you know if you're concerned, call 3131, and then you know think about who the person in charge of the operation is.
Yes, in general, at SIDET and IERC, as far as these are the people I know. The best. Can you mute? Guillermo, can you mute? Thank you. So all these setups have an ORC tag, which is red, is quite well visible. So if anybody sees anything happening in any of these setups, it's really written on the red tag, who is the person responsible for that setup. But I agree with you that the door is one thing that having a name on it would be also useful.
Okay. Especially if it's somewhere, you know, that's not used to seeing doers or whatever, you should really be, when you're moving a door around, you should make sure that it's authorized for that area.
Okay, so this recent incident in IB1, the Christ top flange bolts were not tightened, but E-log entry posted for cryo to proceed. So there was a green line to go ahead. The initial vacuum leak test did not reveal any loose bolts. The IB1 operator opened the valve to bring cryostat to positive pressure while sitting in the control room. And shortly thereafter, there was an ODH alarm activated in the high bay of IB1. And the IB1 control room is on a separate ventilation system, so there was no immediate danger for the operator and did not require evacuation. The IB1 operator isolated the cryostat from the control room approximately 40 seconds after the ODH alarm cleared. And the ODH sensor was directly in the path of the leaking helium. And the measured oxygen concentration dropped close to 14%. But the ODH conditions were highly localized in the location where the leak was. But the IB1 operator did not call extension 3131. And this is wrong. Because for any of such incidents, without fire's connections to the fire department, 3131 needs to be notified for any situation which brings the oxygen concentration. I don't know now why you said below 18% and not 19.5.
So
it should be 19.5.
So one thing that we've had happen in PPD is both in SpinQuest and with PAB, we've had a situation where sensor was right near a valve that gas was allowed to get out under normal circumstances, but. And the sensor probably shouldn't have been that close, but and so the ODH alarms went off, and people said, "Oh, I know what that is. I'm not going to leave because it's harmless or whatever." Don't ever do that. Always leave. And call 3131 and wait for the fire department to make sure things are safe. Don't assume because you think you know what's going on that you don't have to leave.
Okay, so the follow-up was that the ODH monitor system was upgraded to pure air sensors using the SNH interlocks XB chassis. And the IB1 high value ODH system is now connected to FIDO. So if there is any alarm of that type, then the fire brigade will be immediately notified. Right, so the FIDO's emergency alarm automatically leads to dispatch of the fire department when any oxygen reading is below, again, 18%. No, this is
We'll
a
have
bit,
to check on that.
this is a bit, okay, I'm not sure about this level. Okay. IB1 hazard awareness training class is now required for anybody entering IB1. Excuse me. A major focus of upcoming Fashion 4.2.0 revision is on expanding and clarifying ODH event response and re-entry procedures, evidently after an alarm sounded, a dangerous situation. So this is other recent incidents, uncontrolled release of N2 gas at ACBA. So employees were conducting a high pot test, which involved cooling a system down to test an hypothesis that there was moisture trapped within the assembly. Components were mechanically fastened and connected to a portable door. And when the door was opened, a pop was heard as a component failed and the door was closed. No one was injured. Employees were unfamiliar with working with doors and cryogens and had never taken the training or took it many years ago. So, unfamiliar with low versus high pressure doors, liquid versus gas withdrawal ports, etc. Cryogenic safety training did not specifically cover some details of portable doors and was not required at the regular interval. Training has since been updated with some extra specifics on portable doors and is now required by yearly. Reminder that employees unfamiliar, untrained with working with cryogens should not be performing the work without the work planning, proper review, and input from SMEs. Action items from these incidents. Signage. Signage for all cryogenic systems should be verified to be within compliance by DSOs responsible for the areas. General accommodations, equipment testing, verify responsible parties, interlocks, control groups that have tested system at the required intervals to make sure that everything is okay and properly working. Personal monitors, verify personal monitors, that verify the personal monitors are in working order and properly calibrated. Contact industrial hygiene group with any issues. And general walkthroughs, the cryogenic system owner should regularly conduct walkthroughs to inspect for abnormalities, like evidently something is leaking because you have an ice ball or vapor clouds or odd noises. Okay, this is the summary for ODH. As I said, we are exposed only to engineer ODH zero, which is an area relying on active monitoring and ventilation to achieve the ODH class zero classification. And ODH procedures and control measures, response to an alarm from a personal oxygen monitor. If one person is working alone in an area and needs her personal oxygen monitor alarms, the person must immediately, I don't know what that means, self-rescue, I guess, use a self-rescue.
Yeah, that's if you're in an ODH 1 or 2 environment.
Supply, but
yeah.
This is only for ODH 1 and 2, I think. I don't know.
Do we even have self-rescue?
No, because we don't have ODH 1 and 2.
If you're in an ODH 1 or 2, you're required to carry an oxygen monitor and an escape pack with like 10 minutes worth of air or something until you get out.
Okay, this is again if you have an oxygen monitor with you, and you read a value below, not greater but below 19.5%, you should evacuate the area, going away from the source of the problem. Then notify the operations department responsible for the area of the problem. And again, in this situation, if you have a self-rescue mask, you should put it on, evacuate the area, and dial 311. But again, this is not anything that we will do here.
Shouldn't that say less than 19?
Yes, it should say less than. Okay, I am done with the slides. I hope that this was useful.
So, Nicola, I just have one other comment. If I remember my ODH training, an ODH 1 or 2 requires two people to access.
Yes.
For ODH 2, you need two people. ODH 1, you need one person. You can go in with one person.
You just have the oxygen monitor.
You still need the oxygen
monitor. But you need the oxygen monitor. Okay.
Yes.
Thanks, Del. Yep.
Okay, can you let me share?
Yes, of course. Share. I stop share. And you can share now.
Okay. So what I would like to do is review the slides that are part of the CO2 hazard awareness training. Everyone that works inside of the Lab CE clean rooms is required to take this training. If you don't have it on your ITNA, you should ask your supervisor to put it on your ITNA if you do work inside of the clean rooms. So, but the information is also useful for anyone that walks through Lab C, because when alarms go off, everyone needs to leave not only the clean rooms, but also the Lab C shell. So there's been a training like this for at least a dozen years. We upgraded the safety system, life safety system for the Lab C just last year. And so we also revised this training. So hopefully anyone who works in there has also retaken the training since last year, since last August. Okay, so I'll review the slides. Let me know if you have questions. The reason for having CO2 there is because the CMS CO2 test cans are in Lab C. The CMS support teams are testing planks for tracker and cassettes for the calorimeters over the next years for the CMS detector upgrade. We note that CO2 is environmentally friendly compared to CFCs and HCFCs. However, in order to cool the CO2, we are using those. Okay. So CO2 is not exactly like just having an inert gas like nitrogen, helium, or argon. It's colorless, odorless, and should be treated as a material that has low warning properties. In other words, you're not going to smell it or see it. Okay. It's heavier than air, so it'll tend to pool in low spots. The normal concentration of CO2 in air is at 0.04%. 10% or 100,000 ppm is dangerous. Okay. Some signs of being in a area with concentrations this high include headache, sweating, rapid breathing, increased heartbeat, shortness of breath, dizziness, mental depression, or visual disturbances or shaking. So this is basically saying CO2 displaces air if it's leaking. Even if you have somehow maintained 21% oxygen, if you have CO2 in the air, it's going to have effects of an oxygen deficient environment.
The thing to make sure everybody's aware is that CO2 will kill you long before the lack of oxygen does.
Right. So we normally talk about ODH analyses. For this system, we talk about a hazardous atmosphere analysis because CO2 is toxic. I'll just mention to finish off this slide, we have CO2 sensors. Currently, there's one in the south clean room and one in the west aisleway on the outside of the clean room. When we start up the new cold rooms for Zoltan, we will be adding another CO2 sensor in the north clean room. So here's some of the statistics on CO2. So remember that 0.04% is the level in normal air. The time weighted average is 0.5% CO2. That's the limit for an 8-hour work day. We have an alert, we're calling it, at by the time we get to 0.5%. There's another slide that reviews that. The short-term exposure limit is 3%. That's just 15 minutes, what NIOSH allows for a 15-minute period. And it's integrated. So if, this assumes it's at 3% for 15 minutes. So, but that's how that's determined. What we call our alarm is at half of this amount. It's the policy of Fermilab ESH to alarm at half of this level for toxic gases. So 1.5% CO2 is when we have an alarm and we call fires. Immediately dangerous to life and health is 4%. 10% is extremely hazardous, and those are the things that you will notice: headache, sweating, etc., that we mentioned in the previous slide. At lower levels of CO2, symptoms are not always noticed. Okay, so what are the hazards of cold CO2? It's a thermal burn, just like any other cryogenic fluid, although this technically is not cold enough to be considered cryo fluid. We treat it as one for safety. Brief exposures can damage tissues. Cold air can damage lungs. Prolonged contact with skin causes frostbite. You can tear your skin, whether it's metallic or non-metallic. There's some first aid guidance for skin contact, eye contact, inhalation. Guidance here for inhalation comes from the medical office. However, this is also pointing to what Nicola talked about, whether or not if the alarm is going off, calling 3131 is maybe your best option, based on which alarm it is, whether it's the alert alarm or the alarm at which the concentration is at 1.5%. And we have examples of what those alarms sound like in this. Specifically for Lab C, there's 300 pounds of CO2 in the storage tank. That if there's an accident, it could be released either into the housing, the shell of Lab C, or inside of the clean room. So when an alarm goes off, it means get out of both the clean room and out of the Lab C building and stay out until the fire department issues an all clear. So as I mentioned, hazard analysis, hazardous atmosphere analysis was completed, which is like doing an ODH analysis, except for we take into account these values here for the short-term exposure limit and the immediately dangerous life to life and health concentrations, as opposed to like 18% or 8.8% when we think about typical inert gas that is considered for ODH training. Right, so we have CO2 sensors. The brand name of them is MSA. They're suitable and have reliability suitable for life safety. The site operation center is notified if the concentration goes above 1.5%. There's also a handheld monitor. One is located in the west hallway by the system controls, and there's also one inside of the clean room available for checking for leaks, etc. And it can be kept near your breathing space if you want extra reliability on monitoring the area. So we have ventilation for the clean rooms. The ventilation for the clean rooms, the air handling units are on the ceiling on the roof of the clean rooms. There's one for the north clean room, one for the south clean room. If the ventilation, the ventilation is always on, always exchanging air with Lab C. If one of those fans stops, we have a flow sensor, one for each fan. It's going to report it to fire as equipment trouble. Okay. And then they will be contacting a system expert, the SOC. Does everybody know what SOC is? Site, what is it? Site operations center. Yep. It used to be called the Thompson. They call it SOC now. Let's see. Did I tell you what it is? Okay, there's also an exhaust fan that blows air from the Lab C shell to the outdoors, basically sucking air in through all the leaks of Lab C and replacing any contaminated air in Lab C. So the hazard analysis for inside the clean room considers that there's air exchange between the lab shell and inside the clean rooms, and then the lab shell gets fresh air via the fan that blows stale air outdoors and is pulling in fresh air through leaks and cracks in the building.
That fan is an example of what we how we engineered this to be safe. And under normal, without that fan, then it wouldn't necessarily be safe. So we monitor that fan and set off an alarm if that fan fails.
Right. So that would also be recorded or reported to fire as an equipment failure, life safety equipment failure for Lab C. So this is meant to be a map. So on the right is the north end of the building. Here, if you can see my yellow cursor, Lab AC cross connect and then Lab CD cross connect. So this space here is where a lot of people walk through Basically, using Lab C as a hallway. Okay. Then we have the South Clean Room, a North Clean Room. We'll take a quick look at this legend. The little brown circle means that there's a CO2 sensor. The red X is a lighter strobe. They're the same strobes that we use for ODH. We have a similar looking strobe that's yellow, that's for the 0.5 percent alert. The horn siren is this blue shape here, and the ventilation fan is green. Okay, so I'll go around the room. So the big roll-up door is here on the south side. So just so everybody has kind of a idea of where we're talking about. What we don't show on this map is that there's signs. There's signs by every location that you can enter into Lab C. So if you're coming from the Lab AC cross connect, there's signs about that this is a CO2 hazardous area posted on this glass wall here. There's signs by the strobes and horns and by all the other doors leading into this dispenser. So there's a horn and strobe on this south wall. There's a horn and strobe on the west wall. There's a horn and strobe on this east wall. Those have all been tested by industrial hygiene to make sure that they're at the right decibel level, so that everybody, no matter where you are inside of Lab C, can hear them based on their qualifications for horns being loud enough and so on. So there's also the one inside by the pipe skid inside of the south clean room. And when we add a sensor to the north clean room, we'll revisit whether we add a new horn and strobe into the north plate. So look forward to another iteration of this, hopefully within the next 6 months, after we get the north clean room all set up for operating the cold rooms. The CO2 sensors, there's one, most of the CO2 equipment is in this west aisleway, so there's a sensor there. And then by the CO2 skid inside of the south clean room. The yellow X is a yellow light strobe that is specific for the 0.5 percent. And so that is located and applicable for workers inside of the south clean room. Any questions about, oh, and did I say the ventilation fan is here? And then we don't show the fans for the south clean room and north clean room, but they're up on the roof of the clean rooms within the Lab C shell, always exchanging air between the Lab C space and the clean room space. Any questions on the map? Okay, this will go through. Here's the trouble sound. It's not working because my sound is off. I don't know. I think I might have that on the. That's right. Okay. So that's let me. Okay. This is the alarm.
Did everybody on Zoom hear that?
No.
No? Say it again. Do it again. Can you?
Maybe louder.
Okay, so I have to unmute myself while I play these in order for it to happen. So I'll unmute, but then I'll try not to talk.
You're good, good, good. Okay, that's the alarm.
Okay, and that's the alert. The alert is, we actually have, it's hardwired to turn on at 0.5%. The PLC makes it happen at 0.3% just for an extra early notification for workers in the room. Okay, so we have what we're calling the alert or the local trouble alarm 0.3%. This, I think, is specific to anybody that ends up doing work inside of Lab C. And when that kind of work is starting, I think we meet up with Doug and whoever the people are that are working with Doug's system. And then the same thing for Zoltan, as far as trying to do something prior to leaving the room. So. Virus trouble is the equipment. When the equipment has a problem, it could be the exhaust fan, the clean room ventilation I mentioned, or if the CO2 sensor has self-diagnostics, and if it senses that it has having a problem, it'll tell virus, and then fire or yeah, it'll tell virus. It'll tell the SOC via virus, and so the SOC will get a hold of a system expert to let them know. All right, the next page. Yeah, so virus alert, what we decided on is that the evacuation is required after an hour and 20 minutes. This is part of that integration that we talked about earlier, that the Stell, it's not just once you reach 3%. Or the time weighted average is it's an integrated value, and so we did a conservative calculation with industrial hygiene, and this is what they felt comfortable with. So that's also something specific for people who are actually doing work inside of the clean room. The virus alarm, as I mentioned, is the 1.5%. I played the horn sound just a minute ago, and it's exactly the same sound that's used for ODH. Okay. And so experts will be notified. The exhaust fan is automatically turned on. And as Rick mentioned, we do a daily test where the fan goes on. The PLC is checking to see that it actually turned on with a flow sensor. If the flow sensor doesn't determine that it's seeing a flow rate that we expect within, a minute or so, it's going to tell the SOC that there's equipment problems.
So, Dell, just a quick question there. You state that the alarm comes on after an hour and 20 minutes, and that you're supposed to evacuate after an hour and 20 minutes of the 0.5%. Does that mean that you're supposed to evacuate when the alarm goes off?
Yes.
Okay.
The alarm supersedes the alert.
Okay. Yeah, the way it's worded there, it's ambiguous.
Okay. Maybe we can improve that in our next iteration on this. Okay. Last slide. The most important thing, here's a picture of the strobe and the horn, and then the carbon dioxide signs that are pasted around in roughly a half a dozen different places. So if you hear the alarm, the alarm sound that sounds like ODH alarm, you leave both the clean rooms and the Lab C building immediately. I should go back to the map and point out egress. So let's see. So on the north side, you get out, you can get out to the Lab AC cross connect or Lab A and keep walking until the fire department says it's safe to go back in. That's true for any of these egress paths. You can go into Lab CD through this door on the east, or the double doors, which is close to Natola's office. You come out of the clean rooms either through the gowning room from the north or the south. door and then get out as soon as possible into the lab CD cross connect. If you're in the north clean room and you want to get out through the north door, you can do that and then leave via the north door of the building. And there is a door. Most of the time, the roll-up door, at least for the last year, a couple of years, the roll-up door between the south clean room and north clean room is always open, but there is also a personnel door between the two spaces.
And if one is in the lab CD cross-connect, should one stay?
Yeah, you just say it's safe to be in the lab CD cross-connect. Okay, so any questions about the map?
Are there sensors in the north clean room?
Not yet, but once we get, Zoltan is getting new cold rooms. We're getting the piping, we're working on the piping for that now. Once it's all set up, we'll have an ORC. There will be another sensor for the north clean room breathing space, and that will also be connected up to FIRES.
Does that mean that the doors between the north and the south clean rooms need to remain open?
Well, each space has its own ventilation, air handling unit. Okay. We haven't completed the hazardous atmosphere analysis for Zoltan's system yet, so that remains to be seen.
Okay. The reason for the question is if you close the doors and there's no sensors in the north clean room, can you produce a hazardous condition in the north clean room that wouldn't exist in the south clean room?
The rule will always be that if there's an alarm in any one of the areas, the north, south, or the hallway, you get out of all of lab C. That's going to be true, but we will have a sensor in north clean room.
Yeah.
Right now, there's no CO2 source in the north clean room, so there's no sensor.
Okay. Thank you. That clarifies it. Thanks.
Okay, so that's all I have, Nicola, if there's no other questions. So I'll stop sharing.
Yeah. Okay, so I think we don't have anything else for today.
We've talked about some very sensitive, sophisticated hazards, but the highest percentage of accidents that we have at Fermilab are slips, trips, and falls, and cuts to your hands. I highly recommend if you're working with wood or metal, you wear leather gloves. And also with slips, trips, and falls, we're in winter, you know, don't feel like you have to get to work. If you have to go across some ice or deep snow or whatever, stay at home or go back home if the conditions require you to risk yourself. So, you know, it isn't just some of these more sophisticated hazards. There's some very common hazards that we really should pay more attention to, because that's where the largest source of injuries is. So, you know, pay attention to those as well, as well as all these other things that we pointed out to you.
Okay, thank you, Rick. I think we can close the meeting now. And
unless there's questions or concerns or comments that people want to make, I'm happy to send feedback to leadership or whoever if you have any other concerns.
Just thank you. I thought this went really well, considering the very short notice and she's working on stuff. That's great.
Are we at some point going to be told what happened that Saturday, or is that just going to
We cannot, I cannot say anything until it's official. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be kept secret.
It's not a secret, is that the way CERN works is a little bit different, I guess. I don't know. But they want first to go through the full incident. There is a committee working on it. And only when all the facts have been collected and all reality has been established, then they will share. Wow. But as of now, I don't have anything official that I can say.
Is there a history of serious ODH incidents at Fermilab? Wasn't there something 20 or 30 years ago? We've never had a fatality, right? We might have had
No,
some.
No fatalities that I know of.
no.
I mean, we certainly had releases. We used to get them in the Tevatron all the time. Quenches, things,
Small level things
large
like
vapor
ODH
clouds.
alarm, yes, we even had all the time in our clean room, so it's not that happens.
We did have an accident in Lab G that wasn't an ODH situation, but it was from cryogens where the cryostat for SVMS was. They had two volumes, and there was a relief valve on one of the volumes, and there was a pipe going from a larger volume to that volume with the relief valve, and it was assumed that pipe was going to provide the relief needed for that larger volume. And what happened was is it froze up, and when the temperature went up in the cryostat, the larger volume cryostat, obviously it, several hundred times more pressure that the thing couldn't handle, and it blew the top right off. If anybody had been in that area, they might have been very seriously hurt. So that was a big investigation. It's what, 3 or 4 years ago we had this? I can't.
So we have a lot of cryogen-free cryostats, and generally our assumption is that these are pretty safe. But of course, there's the possibility to liquefy air, you get blockages from condensation infections you've got with the older cryostats that were the best safe and have large cryogen. So I wonder if we should have some kind of study of, because now they're proliferating like mushrooms all
Right.
over the lab.
So we do conduct ORCs on all of those systems before they're allowed to operate, and most of them are commercial. And if we do any modifications to them, we have to get those reviewed, engineering reviews on those things. So, like I said, with that Lab G one, you got to make sure that you have relief valves because these cryostats generally cannot handle the pressure of when the cryogens turn to gas and so that's why we put relief valves on all our
There's a pressure
actuating
response,
system
no?
Yeah,
and
of course, on all of these systems. But I wondered if it would make sense to have some kind of dedicated meeting for users of these things where we accumulate
I
it like tests and
I think that would be a very
I think
good
that's a
idea.
good I think that's a good idea for users of those systems to understand where they can get themselves into trouble. I will relay that.
This election machinery, I thought there is a forum where you can submit election machinery and then ESNA makes them available.
I don't know if there is a forum, but if you, because unfortunately we don't have anybody.
ESNH does, yeah, we don't have anybody from ESNH here, but I have received lesson learned things every so often. I'm
Yes.
not sure
But we can relate.
How that
We'll
is.
relate any concern to them. So if you write to me or Rick,
No, I was trying to say, in addition to having this forum to discuss, I believe, because I receive, like Rick does every now and then, messages from ESNH,
Yes.
and they say lessons learned. And I know that in the end of every project, when we go to CD4, etc., we submit officially
Yes.
lessons learned.
Yeah.
But I believe this is happening also live. You don't have to be at the end of the project.
Yeah, I don't know how they determine whether to distribute lessons learned. Obviously, there's a lot more lessons learned than we were getting in the mail.
Yes.
And so that's a good question. I will be like.
Did a certain thing just happen in general, or do something?
It happened
within a few weeks.
Last week.
Last week.
And my understanding was a couple of collaborators were taken to the hospital. They were fine, but there were issues.
Okay,
so it created an incident.
Okay, if there are no further questions.
Yes, I heard there's also then going to be like a safety walkthrough or exercise after this kind of classroom setting. Didn't know anything about that, or is that just...
No, I've not organized any safety walkthrough, but if you want to, I can show you where the...
So Aaron and I are discussing a walkthrough for Lab B,
okay.
Specifically where you were. Okay. So we'll get in touch about that.
Yeah, I mean, if anybody doesn't feel like Bell's map is sufficient, he can walk you through Lab C right now and show you where things are at. It's up to you.
And I think, yes, it's a good idea to organize walkthrough specifically for your equipment.
We also do a safety walkthrough, not a safety right?
Yes. Okay. Thanks a lot, everyone.
Thank you.